Greetings and salutations, friends, and welcome back to The Arcade. We are your video game podcast here to infotain you for the week of Friday, February 28th of the year 2014. It is the end of February already. I am shocked and appalled by this revelation because it means the world is spinning far too fast. I want to get off. I am Mike the Legend, who is now, well, just disappointed by how much time has now passed, seemingly in the blink of an eye, and, well, with time comes other passings, isn't that right?
That is indeed true, and I am the other person on this program. This week I am Dennis, the man who wants to dedicate this week's show to Harold Ramis, and encourages everyone to check out his work beyond Ghostbusters.
Indeed, this week on Monday was the sad passing of Harold Ramis, a Chicago comedian who, writer, producer, actor,
comedy
director.
Legend.
Yes.
Comedy legend, really.
A man who had his fingers in a great many comedy pies. Of course, when we think of Harold Ramis, we can't help but think of his work on the silver screen in the realm of cinema, and I'm sure what the piece of work that comes immediately to people's minds, front and center, is Ghostbusters, thinking of him as Egon Spengler.
Yeah, and I mean, like, Ghostbusters was definitely, I would say, his biggest vehicle. He was, you know, co-starred along three other very talented people in that movie,
mm-hmm.
and co-wrote it with Dan Aykroyd, one of the other co-stars in the movie, and, you know, like, it was permanently imprinted on pop culture, and, you know, anyone in our age range, and, you know, a few years older, a few years younger, certainly loved Ghostbusters when it came out, us being no exception on this program.
Definitely.
But when I think of Harold Ramis, my favorite Harold Ramis movies aren't Ghostbusters.
And I think this is probably something that bears mentioning, is that he did a lot more than Ghostbusters, and probably worked on movies, in some capacity, that you might not have expected that he would have worked on.
Yeah, I mean, like, he's worked on a ton of classic comedies, but a lot of these classic comedies, you don't necessarily think that was a Harold Ramis movie, because, you know, they were often vehicles for other people, like, most notably Bill Murray was the lead actor in a lot of the different movies that were Harold Ramis movies.
But also, too, even before Bill Murray, John Belushi.
Yeah. I mean, what people might not realize, Harold Ramis wrote Animal House. Animal House. Like, you know, one of the very first screwball American comedies.
From the 70s?
Yeah.
That, I believe that even predates his work on SCTV, which we'll talk about in a minute, but that's how early he really got into the movie world, and how often do you even hear of Animal House as being a movie that was written by Harold Ramis?
Yeah, like, you normally think John Belushi, National Lampoon, cool.
No, and leave it at that.
It's like, oh yeah, that was a National Lampoon movie, like the first National Lampoon movie. Yep, it was, but it was also written by Harold Ramis. Yeah. So, then moving from there, I mean, there's his work at SCTV, which, honestly, it's impossible to not leave an indelible mark on me anyways. I mean, mm-hmm. I grew up watching SCTV reruns, and as I'm sure a lot of us in our age range did, at least in Canada anyways. And he wrote a ton of movies, Caddyshack, Stripes, probably his most cerebral comedy being Groundhog Day.
Even Caddyshack is another movie where, when you think of it, you don't make the association between Caddyshack movie and Harold Ramis.
No, but Caddyshack. Stripes. Harold Ramis was in Stripes.
So that's a bit more obvious.
That's a little bit more obvious, but he also wrote it, and, like, you know, Groundhog Day. Harold Ramis wrote and directed Groundhog Day.
And you would never think that.
No. Like, he wrote and directed Groundhog Day.
Again, when you think a similar case as with Animal House or you know, some of the other movies, like Caddyshack, you think Groundhog Day, and Harold Ramis does not even enter into the conversation, because that is a movie where it is your primary thoughts are entirely consumed with Bill Murray.
Yeah.
And rightfully so.
I mean, like, don't get me wrong. Like, Bill Murray was great in all those movies, but he was great, I think also in part due to, like, the roles he was given and, like, just the story that kind of surrounded him. Like, if I were to put a front runner for my favorite Harold Ramis movie, I would say it was either Stripes or it was Groundhog Day. Like, they're pretty much tied for different reasons, like, in my head. Groundhog Day, because, like, the concept is so incredible.
Oh, it's so high concept.
Like I can't think of a single other movie that is as high concept and well executed as Groundhog Day. And Stripes, because it's just off the wall ridiculous. And, like, just the interplay between the cast was so awesome. But, yeah, I mean, like, then, you know, I mean...
I think part of why those movies work, too, if I may offer a point here as well, is that Harold Ramis, one of his strengths was writing and knowing how to write for Bill Murray.
Yeah, exactly.
And getting the most out of Bill Murray.
Yeah, I mean, I think an actor like Bill Murray as well, to a lot of writers and directors and whatever else, I think he would be a pretty intimidating guy to have to make stuff up for or to try to work with,
mm-hmm.
you know, just given his pedigree and stuff. But the thing about Harold Ramis, he came up at the same time as Bill Murray, so he was a direct peer to him.
Definitely.
So that's the kind of other mind-boggling thing. And I mean, even another thing that is pretty crazy about Harold Ramis that you might not realize, I mean, I realize it because I watched the movie several times, even going back to when I was 8 years old, which my dad probably shouldn't have let me watch it, but it was heavy metal. Harold Ramis was in heavy metal.
He was a voice in heavy metal.
Like, no, like, there were no actual actors, like, depicted in heavy metal. It was an animated movie, but it was an adult animated movie. It was a very adult animated movie.
And you were allowed to watch this again?
Yes. When I was 8.
Well, that explains many things.
But, yeah, he was in heavy metal, just like several other SCTV members were. You know, John Candy, Joe Flaherty, etc. But, yeah, I mean... And then SCTV, of course. We have to come back to SCTV as well.
We definitely do.
Like, he may not have had the most... Like, most of the other cast members on SCTV had very front-of-mind...
Iconic characters.
And unfortunately, he never really... Like, Harold Ramis never really had as iconic of a character, I think.
You know, exactly. None may be as memorable or standout or unique as, say, Bob and Doug McKenzie and Edith Prickly and Egg Grimley.
And Don Caballero. And
exactly. Or the Schmangy Brothers.
Or the Schmangy Brothers and whatnot. But yeah, but even still, Harold Ramis was great on the show for his either supporting roles or just, like, whenever they needed just, like, a weird one-off character to just kind of throw it, just a bizarre concept.
A weird one-off kind of straight man character.
Yes, kind of straight man character. I mean, there was a very awesome sketch. It might be a bit fitting and maybe, like, a little bit morbid, but I think this is a great... We're going to play... It was a sketch called So You're Dead, Now What? That Harold Ramis delivered impeccably. And we'll let the audio speak for itself.
I'm Maurice Green, licensed chiropractor. Did you know that each year more than 20,000 people die? Well, this year you may have passed away without even being aware of it. Here are 7 simple warning signs that may spell the difference between life and death for you. 1. Prolonged absence of physical activity. 2. Loss of appetite. 3. Loss of sight and hearing. 4. Increasing stiffness of joints and muscles. 5. Relaxed attitudes toward personal hygiene. 6. Inability to remember the previous 5 warning signs. And 7. The unexplained presence of coins on your eyelids. If you answered yes to any or all of these warning signs, you may already be dead. Don't be the last to know. Write today for this free booklet, So You're Dead, Now What? Box 1977, Gettysburg, Virginia. Do it today. It's a matter of life and death.
I don't care if that's morbid. I'm pretty sure he would have wanted it that way.
I can't think of a more appropriate sketch to pull from SCTV to kind of illustrate and demonstrate his work on there. And the fact that, again, he made such a great straight man.
Yeah, I mean, few of the other characters on... Well, a few of the other actors, I should say, on SCTV could play straight men as well as as he could, you know, like...
And that was kind of really his forte, his strength. Even in Ghostbusters, Egon is very straight-laced, too.
Even in Stripes as well, he was like...
Good point.
He was more of, like, the anchor to the zany Bill Murray craziness that happened, and... Yeah, it's just... Yeah, that's... Every great comedy needs great straight men to anchor the not straight craziness, and that's just... was his forte.
It really was. That was his strength, what he played too so well. I mean, he just had the look of a straight man too. Just
yes.
Naturally, that was his, you know, that was his face, that was his, you know, demeanor, and just he looked like a good straight man, and made such a great pairing with Bill Murray, and it, crying shame that he is now gone. He will be missed, considering, I mean, again, as you... Even just go through his IMDb page or his Wikipedia page, just the work he's done is astounding that you don't realize initially.
And also, but, you know, we still have to also bring it also back to Ghostbusters, because perhaps most devastatingly, this does definitely put a big question mark around Ghostbusters 3.
It certainly does. I know Ernie Hudson has been out there saying that he doesn't think that a third Ghostbusters movie could go forward without... Harold Ramis as a part of it, although there's reports out of, I guess, in certain Hollywood papers, journals, you know, Daily Entertainment news papers or whatnot, saying that apparently Dan Aykroyd and Ivan Reitman and the studio are trying to figure out how Harold Ramis' passing affects Ghostbusters 3, the third movie, and I believe the scuttlebutt is that he was only ever going to have a cameo in it anyway, so this maybe isn't as big an impact to the movie as if, say, you know, Bill Murray or Dan Aykroyd were to have passed instead.
Yeah, even though... I don't know...
But it seems wrong to do it without him.
It really does. I mean, Egon Spengler was really many people's favorite character from the movie. And that, you know, he played, like, the most legitimate scientist in the movie, really. Like, he was the scientist out of all of them, honestly. Mm-hmm. Like, everyone else seemed smart-ish, except for Bill Murray's character. Even though, you know, Bill Murray being the zany guy, and... But Egon Spengler, yeah, just the straight man, but the most legit scientist, and kind of like a beacon to nerdy kids everywhere that, you know, wow, he's cool, he's on a movie.
And true enough that they could look on the screen and see... You know, almost maybe sometimes a reflection of themselves. If,
yeah.
You know, someone with their interests shared on the screen and, you know, maybe enabled them to follow their path of science or technology or whatever else that interested them, because they were able to see that, you know, there is someone like them out there and on the big screen, and that perhaps gives them some hope. But for Ghostbusters 3, remains to be seen. But even if there isn't a third movie, there's always the Ghostbusters video game of a couple of years ago that was always intended to be the third movie anyway.
Yeah.
And his voice is in there, the full voice cast from all the actors. So there's at least that, but I don't know. I feel mixed on a third Ghostbusters movie.
Yeah, I'm less than... I mean, I was always sort of skeptical, you know, what with Bill Murray's in and out, that he was kind of dancing around for years, really.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of clinches it that I'm really kind of less interested now. If they're going to really push forward with this, like a Ghostbusters with no Egon or with, like, a simulated Egon, like, come on, really?
It'd be like trying to do a Wayne's World with only Wayne instead of Garth.
Yeah. Like, you need both. You need the whole package.
Ghostbusters was all four of them. It was the team of them. To a lesser extent, you know, even Rick Moranis or whatnot. But,
yeah.
You know, ultimately the four of them were the main core team of the Ghostbusters. And it, even in some way without Egon, even if he wasn't going to be a big part, there, you know, should still have some appearance, some cameo. But without him, I don't know.
Yeah.
If there's money to be made, people will do it, but I'm sure a lot of the fans of the original Ghostbusters films will be, I don't know, have some leery feelings about it, but time will tell. But Harold Ramis will be missed. If you find yourself with some time this weekend, do enjoy some of his work that is not Ghostbusters. We encourage you to check out At the very least, Groundhog Day, Animal House.
Animal House.
Stripes.
Caddyshack. Even watch heavy metal, like, for the hell of it, you know?
Or dig up some SCTV, either on the TV, perhaps you have some of the box sets, or hell, even on the internet, you can find just clips, left, right, and center.
Yes.
Of Harold Ramis on SCTV. That's,
Another good SCTV sketch, actually. He played a little bit character called Officer Friendly. Look up Officer Friendly. That's a good sketch.
Maybe he doesn't live up to his name, but it's a fun juxtaposition anyways.
Indeed.
But Harold Ramis, he will be missed. But we can't spend all of our time dwelling on the fact that the comedy world is now lesser without one person this week. We still have other business to get to, and as best we can, we shall attempt to soldier on, and one of the ways we shall do that is with this week's Ludicrous Lead-Off.
Yes, and we've returned to the world of Science Goes Crazy this week with, science going crazy again.
Oh, it's been a while.
You know, we've talked, you know, a fair amount about manipulation scientists have been doing to various senses with rats and whatnot.
Yes.
By making senses react to the wrong senses, etc. Or implanting senses, or just doing weird things with types of light and stuff on the UV spectrum and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And this week is another extension of them doing things with senses. Specifically the sense of touch and pain. Like causing pain receptors to feel pain when there is only light.
Or causing the sensation of pain to go away with only the use of light. You might recall a story we talked about last year as a Ludicrous Lead-Off when we spoke of scientists who were able to turn on and off, like a switch, the, hunger. The sensation of hunger in rats and mice that... scientists were able to do that with the use of fiber optic lights implanted into the brain of the mice. They could turn off the sense of hunger, and a rat would just not eat. Doesn't matter how hungry it was, it could not get over the fact that it did not have that sensation of hunger.
Yeah.
And it worked the opposite way, where a rat would keep eating.
Even when it wasn't hungry.
Even when it wasn't hungry, exactly. If it was told to eat.
Yes.
So that's potentially providing some relief, some therapies down the road for individuals who do have eating disorders, one way or the other, either too much or not enough. But now that same kind of research can be applied to the sensation of pain in the brain, and perhaps paving a new way for therapies and treating pain that does not involve opiates or other medication.
It's definitely more important than causing pain when there is none is relieving pain when there is some.
Exactly, and perhaps doing away with the need for opiates and just other, medications that some people have been known to get addicted to.
Yes.
Through the therapeutic uses of.
Yes, the therapeutic usage of painkillers leading towards an addiction to painkillers.
Like morphine.
Like morphine and, you know...
T3s.
T3s, Percocet. And,
yes.
You know, the one that Dr. House used, whose name is escaping me, Vicodin.
Oh, that's a good one, too. Fentanyl.
The various things that are addiction forming and mm-hmm. not good for you in the long term, you know, have various, you know, various ill effects that go beyond the short-term positive effects of dealing with pain. So if you know, you don't need to risk causing an addiction with someone, that would be awesome because addictions are bad.
Certainly, and this positive news, these positive developments are coming by way of the BioX lab at Stanford University in the United States of America, and quite simply, the team of scientists working there have been able to develop a way to turn pain on and off simply by using light. It is a technique that is known as optogenetics, and with it, they insert light-sensitive proteins called opsins into the nerves of lab mice. Now, after a couple weeks of being in there, the nerves become light sensitive.
Yes, so, you know, naturally, when nerves become light sensitive, not just your eyes can tell different colors at this point. It's whatever nerves that are, you know, coated or whatever with these opsins. So they found that by shining different colors of light on these opsins, they can kind of tap into pain receptors in these rats.
Exactly.
In mice,
one color of light that they would shine would increase the sensation of pain, while another color of light would decrease the sensation of pain, because different colors of light carry different energies to them, different wavelengths.
Yes. Now, I don't think they want to release the bad color, necessarily, to the world, because that could be bad. In, you know, just in general, but the good color, that's what they're mostly interested in.
That is true, but I guess what's impressive about this, too, is that they apparently made these discoveries, or this discovery that you can do this with pain receptors, they made it by accident. Apparently what happened is that, according to Carl Deseroth, who as a pioneer in the burgeoning field of optogenetics, and he co-authored a study about this new technique that was published earlier this month in Nature Biotechnology. He was saying that the lab made the discovery while exploring the use of optogenetics to control muscle movement when they found that the opsins were also affecting the nerves that controlled pain. A quote here from Scott Delp, who worked in the lab and was on the team of researchers. He says, quote, "We thought, wow, we're getting pain neurons? That could be really important," he says in a statement. And so that led them down the path of further exploring, hey, how does this work? What can it do? What are the limitations?
Yes. I know. It's no secret that light and the sun and everything has positive effects on humans, but this definitely takes it a step further.
It certainly does. Now, we don't know how this is going to work, you know, in humans or whatnot. It's still in the mice research stage.
Yes, very much in the mice research stage. Firmly in the mice research stage, hopefully until they have it locked down, you know, that maybe only you could let that one type of light through. I don't want to be, you know, on some sort of light treatment therapy or something for some crazy pain when some troll just changes the color in the light therapy and causes me more pain. That doesn't sound very fun.
So this could lead to a future where perhaps in some, you know, sci-fi programs we've seen, maybe like a Star Trek or whatnot, where your heroes are trapped in a room and there's light that's filling the room and it's red light and it's causing them all pain and they're overacting to the hilt. Well, that could actually be a thing that happens in the future.
Yeah.
But we shall see. Now, also, too, it's not just a simple matter of you shine light on whatever. I mean, if you have a broken hand, you're not going to simply shine the red beam, yellow beam, whatever it is of light on it, and pain's going to go away. You do also have to then coat the nerve receptors in those opsins.
Yes.
Those are kind of critical to this fact.
These opsins are critical, and I'm assuming that the full effect of these opsins on your nerves are not fully known yet.
Certainly not.
Which is why this is still very firmly in the mice phase.
Exactly. You don't know how they are going to interact with the body over a prolonged period of time, but initial indications are that there's some positive developments here. Time will tell how it all plays out, but this, if it works out, then light therapy doesn't sound as bollocks and crazy as maybe you would think it does when you're watching those late night infomercials for this laser healing device or infrared light device where you just shine it on your, you know, back or area that hurts and it'll take the pain away.
Yeah, or that stupid hair regrowth cap that, you know, you just put on and it just shoots UV rays into your skull with the purpose of theoretically growing your hair back. And it looks just like a baseball cap.
Exactly those. Those, I mean, while they pretty much, you know, strike most of us as being bollocks right now, they could have fun, you know, actual uses in the future. But not yet. So don't go out and just buy those things right away.
No.
That's what we're saying. Another item that we are suggesting that you do not go out and buy right away is Duke Nukem Mass Destruction. Simply because it may not see the light of day.
Yes, not only should you not buy it, you won't be able to buy it, probably, at least anytime soon.
Duke Nukem Mass Destruction is the, well, the action RPG that we spoke of a couple of weeks ago that was being teased by Interceptor Entertainment and Apogee Games, that there was a countdown clock and a teaser site with, I think, all out of, you know, an image of alloutofgum.com, or a pack of All Out of Gum.
Yeah.
And cryptic text that was decoded on a Facebook post by the internet, because you can't not have something decrypted by people on the internet.
Yep, that's just, you know, the internet is the best detective agency you will ever find, especially when it comes to people injuring cats and, you know, lost pets and whatnot. Mostly pet-related things. But, you know, on occasion when people want to play new video games or figure out new things about video games, the internet will take to that as well. And, you know, Duke Nukem is kind of a long-standing fan-favorite character, so people see Duke Nukem and want to go, oh, let's figure out some more information about this. But as it turns out, you know, remember a few years ago when Gearbox Software kind of took over Duke Nukem and all that stuff?
Well, by, I mean, take over, I'm sure you mean they just bought the property outright.
Yeah, like, so they own Duke Nukem.
They do. Lock, stock, and barrel. They
like,
know
the intellectual property of Duke Nukem and whatnot.
The name, the character, the likeness, anything related to Duke Nukem, they own. And that was kind of the deal. Well, not the deal, but that's kind of what came out in the wake and happened in the wake of the latest, you know, Duke Nukem actually getting that new game released after a mere 14, 15-year period.
Yeah, and after 3D Realms finally throwing in the towel-ish for a bit there.
Yes.
When that whole ridiculous garbage happened with 3D Realms that we don't really need to get into.
Yeah.
We talked about it on the program a couple years ago when it happened, and it was a thing that definitely happened, but
3D Realms essentially just you know, gave up Duke Nukem and kind of went kaput after that, and but I guess for legal purposes they then kind of transmorphed into something called Apogee Games.
Yeah.
Or Apogee Software, excuse me. But either way, between them and Interceptor Entertainment, they were the parties behind this Duke Nukem Mass Destruction, which was, again, going to be an action RPG for the PC and PlayStation 4.
Yeah, I guess Apogee / 3D Realms forgot that they must have given up all of the rights to Duke Nukem to Gearbox. And they also kind of forgot to include Gearbox in this whole new Duke Nukem plan, because Gearbox apparently had no idea about this, and Gearbox was not happy about this.
And Gearbox got litigious.
Yes.
As they should.
Yes, as they very well should.
Yeah, this is not a frivolous lawsuit. This is not someone trolling or being a jerk. This is someone saying, what the hell?
Yeah, this would be like someone just trying to make, you know, a new Mickey Mouse movie or something. Or, you know, maybe make a new season of Futurama without anyone knowing.
Or, you know, actually having the legal authority and consent to do so.
Yeah, it would be like me trying to make a new
Mickey Mouse
Final Fantasy game or something.
Exactly.
Like, I can't do that. I don't own the name Final Fantasy. Square Enix would sue me out of, sue the pants off me.
They would sue you into non-existence.
Yeah, they would sue my pants off if I was lucky. I'll just put that out there.
That is very true.
So anytime, especially anytime when there's some sort of notable intellectual property at stake, people get kind of protective about it.
That they certainly do, and Gearbox did just that late last week. They filed a federal lawsuit against 3D Realms and Interceptor Entertainment, seeking damages and a formal injunction for trademark infringement, unfair competition, copyright infringement, and breach of contract against both 3D Realms and Interceptor Entertainment. In the filing, Gearbox alleges that 3D Realms and Interceptor are seeking to, quote, misappropriate and make infringing use of the Duke Nukem trademarks and copyrights owned by Gearbox. And, yeah, here's the funny thing about that. So you would, you know, can understand if maybe Interceptor was brought into it by, say, 3D Realms, and, you know, they're just the development studio, and 3D Realms said, hey, you want to make a new Duke Nukem game? And I could imagine maybe Interceptor saying, okay.
Yeah, they might not have been aware of the ins and outs of the business deal between 3D Realms and Gearbox Software at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, well, even still, they might have just been a young company or something and did that. even though, you know, there's also that devil's advocate part of you that goes, yeah, but, you know, anytime a big character like that is involved, you should probably look at the legal history of the character and see who owns what, just to be absolutely sure, you know? But you know, no, it's more stuff is afoot.
Oh, very much afoot, because the lawsuit, the interesting thing to note about the lawsuit is that 3D Realms apparently knowingly, full well knowing that they didn't actually have the legal rights to the Duke Nukem character, the intellectual property anymore, well, they tried to say maybe the other thing was true. Quote here from the legal filing says, apparently, after selling its Duke Nukem intellectual property rights to Gearbox in 2010, 3D Realms sought to privately convince others that the sale never happened. The result is the unauthorized development effort that reportedly exists between 3D Realms and Interceptor Entertainment, end quote. Which is a hell of a thing.
Yes, and continuing the quote, you know, they go on to say, by attempting to license the unlicensable, assign the unassignable, and effectively resell the exclusive rights that Gearbox already purchased in 2010, 3D Realms breached the terms of its asset purchase agreement with Gearbox, as well as Gearbox's exclusive, federally protected intellectual property rights. Unfortunately, the 3D Realms interceptor maneuver has left Gearbox with little choice but to bring these claims.
And the funny thing is, this isn't the first legal filing that Gearbox has made about the matter. As you can imagine, the first course of action, as would happen with any sort of copyright infringement, is you don't go straight to federal lawsuit, you file a cease and desist and just say, okay, stop, you can't do that.
It's like, what the hell are you doing? Remember when you sold us Duke Nukem because you were out of business?
And exactly.
Filed for bankruptcy, and Yeah, we own it now. You can't do this.
It's like, here's a cease and desist from our lawyer. You're infringing upon these things. Halt. Full stop. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Funny thing, 3D Realms doesn't give a damn about that. They'll see your, you know, cease and desist letter and wipe their ass with it. Because the lawsuit also reveals a 3D Realms response to a cease and desist letter sent by Gearbox, regarding the Mass Destruction, a game that concedes, quote, all future development in the Duke Nukem IP is a development right exclusively held by Gearbox. And they admit, 3D Realms admits, quote, development efforts such as 3D Realms' Duke Nukem Mass Destruction effort with others was not only unauthorized, but a material infringement of the Gearbox's rights. So they fully well acknowledged that, yeah, we shouldn't be doing this, and kept going.
Which is insane. What are they trying to accomplish?
A great line here from the lawsuit, quote, as the filing shows, 3D Realms' wrongdoing is both admitted and unfortunate for everyone who cares about Duke Nukem.
So there's a supplied statement from Gearbox Software.
Indeed. So they know full well what they're doing is wrong. But they kept doing it anyway.
Yes, essentially, this is, like, almost directly equivalent to someone selling someone else a car, keeping a copy of the key to the car, keeping track of where the person lives with the car, going in at night, taking the car back, and then selling it to someone else. And then that other person going, what are you doing with my car? And then I'm going, yeah, I probably shouldn't have sold it.
Yeah.
But I did anyways. It's like, no, you actually can't do that. You don't own that. You can't sell something you don't own. You are insane if you think you are. I don't understand what they're doing. What are they doing?
I'm willing to just absolve Interceptor of really any liability.
Yeah, Interceptor just seems like an unfortunate, albeit a bit, perhaps, naive, unfortunate, caught in the crossfire here.
I'd imagine that there were some emails, I'm willing to imagine that there were some emails, some communication between Interceptor and 3D Realms saying, do you guys still own this? I thought you sold it a couple years ago in 3D Realms. Some representative of 3D Realms going, yeah, no, we still got it, it's all good. And that right there, that removes the culpability from anyone at Interceptor. If you have some form of acknowledgement from 3D Realms saying, yeah, no, it's all good, we still have it or whatever else, don't worry about it.
For all we know, 3D Realms provided a bunch of phony documents to Interceptor saying, oh, yeah, well, here, we bought it back. And that might, you know, that might be the case. And that I'm sure Interceptor can easily get out of this.
Definitely. And now the question is, who is in charge at 3D Realms, and what sort of substances are they on, either medicinal or other, have they been ingesting to think that this was a scheme that they could get away with?
I just don't understand what they're thinking. Like, move on. Like, you sold Duke Nukem. It's not yours anymore. Like, it doesn't matter what nostalgic attachment you have to this character you created 30 years ago. You don't own it now. Like, it's gone. You have to move on.
I think we've all worked for some maybe bad bosses, bad management, bad leadership of a corporation, of an enterprise. This is just outright flagrant.
Yeah, this goes beyond anything that's bad. This is insane.
This is egregious of all levels, and I certainly... I'm not usually one who advocates for lawsuits and legal proceedings, but I sure hope this goes all the way for Gearbox. They take it to the hilt and do their best to utterly crush anyone involved on 3D Realms' end.
Yeah, I mean, there is that one classic quote, you know, it's easier to beg forgiveness than ask permission. True. But a more tactful route would have perhaps been to make the game first, not tell anyone about it, then maybe approach Gearbox, say, we have this new Duke Nukem game.
And strike a partnership.
Strike some sort of partnership, license deal or something. That might have been an easier road to go down than just trying to set up some website and, you know, showing concept art and stuff. Perhaps even, I don't know how far this got. I don't know what development was done or whatnot, but hopefully not a lot. But I don't understand. Like, this is, like, mind-boggling.
My only advice to anyone in this is to Interceptor Entertainment and simply to say, make sure the check's cleared.
Yes.
That's it.
Yeah.
Make sure you got your money.
Make
That's
sure the
it.
Check's cleared.
Walk away.
Make sure you have all of the documents signed by 3D Realms saying that they own Duke Nukem, and you're fine.
Yep.
You're fine.
Yep, walk away.
Say, no, we're not involved with this anymore. This is insane.
I don't understand how that can happen, but it did. It's a thing, and we will most definitely keep you apprised of the situation as it unfolds in the courts.
I want to know what other companies 3D Realms tried to pull this with.
True enough.
And what their grand plan is, because this is, like, honestly, I've said this a ton of times already in the last 2 minutes, but yeah, I have no idea. This is mind-boggling to me.
Oh, absolutely baffling, like that something like this could take place, but we are not there, we are not in the conversations, we're not in the room, so it's very hard to imagine for us just how this would all come about, because we are sane, rational people, and I'm not trying to imply that anyone who would try and sell a game that, or create or sign a contract for development of a game that they don't legally hold the rights to is insane, but you know, the facts kind of speak for themselves here.
I mean, it's not even just some little indie character or anything. Duke Nukem has been in the public consciousness for over 2 decades.
Clearly they tried to pull a fast one.
Yeah, clearly.
At the very least, they tried to pull a fast one here, but we'll keep you apprised of the situation as it unfolds, but a situation that is unfolding this weekend, as of today, the day this show is released on Friday, February 28th, is the fact that Activision is shutting down the Call of Duty Elite service, the social networking service for Call of Duty Elite.
That's the one that tracks stats for all the Call of Duty games and was actually being phased out for a while.
Exactly. It initially launched in 2011, and there was a big to-do about it. This was going to be the social network hub for Call of Duty-specific fans and information. There was going to be original content, original programming released through the Call of Duty Elite Service. There's going to be also maps and stat tracking and videos and a whole bunch of, awesome stuff that would be used to justify the $50 a year premium, or price for the premium version of Call of Duty Elite, but there was also a free one which was more limited to just stat tracking and leaderboards and, some competitions and whatnot, so we're trying to see how much money can they just bilk out of the Call of Duty fan base.
Yes.
And I guess as time went on, they realized, maybe this isn't as stellar as we thought, and now that's not to say it didn't do gangbusters upon launch. I mean, when it started, or very early on when it started, it had around 10 million members or 10 million signups, either for the free or premium service.
Yeah.
Though as time went on, that kind of dwindled. Though apparently at one point, again, 2 million users were paying for it. So that's a lot of greenbacks.
Yes, yes, it is.
And for Activision, that's making the shareholders happy. But as time went on, more and more of the features from the Call of Duty Elite service got integrated into some of the games, to the point where I believe even the last one, Ghosts, had pretty much everything you would have needed from Call of Duty Elite, thereby rendering it almost obsolete. Also working against it is the fact that Activision was putting more and more effort, time, and energy into developing and working on the Call of Duty app as a means of replacing it.
Yes, where that app, that they're now kind of, well, they said that the plan, apparently, well, in an FAQ about Call of Duty Elite, Activision said that the plan was for their current Call of Duty app to replace Elite. Going on to say that, and I quote, "There are no plans to bring Call of Duty Elite back. We encourage fans to download the Call of Duty app for Call of Duty Ghosts, which allows players to customize their multiplayer character and weapons loadouts on the go, keep track of their Call of Duty Ghost stats, and features Call of Duty Clan Wars, where players can compete for cool exclusive in-game gear."
Ooh.
So, sounds neat as well, but, they want people to use this app instead of, which makes sense, instead of some big crazy social networking service. Because honestly, we already have enough social networking sites.
This is true.
I mean, trying to go up against Facebook is kind of silly.
And also, too, I mean, working in the features directly into the game that gives you a means of better ensuring that they're actually going to get used, and you can better track and analyze how well they're actually doing and what's working, what's not, versus forcing people to go outside of the game to this other thing.
Yeah.
It's a more direct relationship.
Yeah, so, especially since, if people are going to go outside of this thing to get, various services, do you think they're not already going to go to a more established outside thing, like Facebook? That's just my thought. But I'm also apparently a pessimist, so we won't go there.
I find that very hard to believe. But nevertheless, so if you're...
So RIP Call of Duty Elite is basically the TLDR version of this one story.
It certainly is. If you were a user of Call of Duty Elite and you're saddened by this information, let us know just how distraught you are over it. Send us an email, info@thearcadeshow.com, or send us a message through the Contact Us form on our website, thearcadeshow.com. This is how you can get in touch with us, but Konami getting in touch with some people through the press this week, releasing some more details about Metal Gear Solid Ground Zeroes ahead of its release in just a couple weeks' time. Last we spoke about it, it was being maligned for just how short the game allegedly is supposed to be, Ground Zeroes being the precursor to the Phantom Pain. Ground Zeroes, the one where you infiltrate the Cuban military base and are on search or hunting to rescue a particular character. But it's an open-world game. And, of course, that's going to tide people over, apparently, allegedly, supposedly, tide them over until Phantom Pain comes out at some indeterminate point in the future.
Yes, though, from the reviews we read, it won't necessarily do that, since it's really short.
Yes, apparently not the most satisfying of experiences. You might be hungry after downing Ground Zeroes, but nevertheless, some tidbits, some factoids, some things worth mentioning this week in terms of Metal Gear Solid Ground Zeroes is that, first and foremost, the Xbox One and PlayStation 4 versions have received a price cut. They were originally $40 for either retail or digital versions of the game, now down to $30.
For both.
For both, yes.
Despite the fact that a retail copy, you also get a physical copy of the game, whereas a download, you don't.
This is true.
Sorry. I've complained about this so many times on this program, but might as well complain about it one more time. You know, I got the microphone in front of my face right now.
You're here now. Exactly, the soapbox. It is yours.
Blows my mind that they still charge the same price for both. When you get more stuff out of the other, and you don't have to worry about a download time, necessarily. Just putting that out there.
It's something we've never been able to figure out, much like the mismatch numbers of hot dogs and hot dog buns when they come in their separate packages.
Indeed.
One of those great mysteries of the universe.
Yes.
But if you are an individual who is maybe not fully set on getting Ground Zeroes yet, but you are thinking you'll really want to wait until Phantom Pain comes out, Konami has said that if you go ahead and buy Ground Zeroes, you'll be able to get some exclusive DLC for Phantom Pain when it eventually comes out, which may be a year, year and a half, 2 years? Who the hell knows?
Yeah, who knows how long, you know, Phantom Pain will be, because I'm pretty sure Kojima will just take his damn sweet time regardless with it.
Which is
okay, because he is known for his quality of his games.
Exactly. He's not really known to crank them out, so okay, we'll give him the benefit of the doubt here, but the DLC that's been spoken of that will have some connection to Phantom Pain will allow players, or give players, additional resources for a mother base area that's featured in Phantom Pain. According to Konami, this mother base area will be introduced during the Ground Zeroes campaign and play a, quote, central role in Phantom Pain. The DLC is included only in the, quote, first batch of Ground Zeroes retail copies and for a limited, quote, limited period of time for the digital version. So they're trying to make it exclusive, so you go out there and get it right away.
In addition, Konami says that players who have this DLC will have a, quote, unquote, edge over other players who don't. And it's not clear if the DLC will be available for separate purchase. My money's on it's not.
Or my money is it will be later, but closer towards, you know, the release of Phantom Pain, or when it comes out.
Or maybe even a good month or so after it comes out.
Certainly.
So maybe let those people who bought this Ground Zeroes thing wallow in it a bit.
Enjoy their exclusivity of it, but eventually it's going to come out because people will pay for it, and it will make money. Sorry if I'm being cynical here, but money kind of motivates everything.
Yes, money does make the world go round.
Konami also said that players who purchase Ground Zeroes will unlock, quote, exclusive content that will carry over to the Phantom Pain. Specifically, prisoners of war and VIPs rescued in Ground Zeroes will appear in the Phantom Pain as staff in your mother base area. Character skins can also be carried over from Ground Zeroes to Phantom Pain. Konami went on to also announce that there's going to be a second screen experience, an iDroid app for Ground Zeroes.
Apparently, it's a great name, by the way.
Exactly. It's going to be
lowercase I, capital D droid, which is hilarious.
It's the best of both worlds, and it's going to be available for free on the iOS, Android, and Xbox Smart Glass platforms, and it will replicate Big Boss's in-game communication map and device. And using the iDroid app, players will be able to call up maps, enlist the help of air support, or play cassette tapes that they find in Camp Omega. And if you're unsure of when all this comes out, because now you're interested, this has put you over the top, and you really have to get your hands on Ground Zeroes. It comes out on March 18th for new-gen and previous-gen systems that aren't named Nintendo Wii something.
Yes, and once again, no idea when the Phantom Pain will be out.
Certainly not.
No idea. Whatsoever. We will let you know when we know anything, though, but that's not yet. We have no idea.
No. No one knows anyone, or nobody knows anything about Phantom Pain outside of Kojima, and I'm sure even some of his staff are still in the dark about a time frame yet. They're working away. They're slogging away at it, and it's, you know, he's pretty demanding. Unlike, say, a studio like Rovio, who just enjoys cranking things out.
Yes, the very, well, similar things to previous things, but apparently brand new.
Yes, it was just a couple weeks ago, 2 weeks ago, that they announced that there's going to be a new pillar in the Angry Birds universe. We have Angry Birds Core, we have Angry Birds Go, which is their kart racing thing, but also has tie-ins to physical toys. There's also the Star Wars Angry Birds titles that have done very well.
Angry Birds in Space. There's a million Angry Birds games out there.
Exactly, but maybe, you know, certain members of the public felt that, or certain segments of the public felt that, you know, Angry Birds didn't really speak to them. So instead, Rovio has announced that in fall 2014, they will be releasing something called Angry Birds Stella. And according to their initial press release, it says, quote, "Get ready to meet Stella and her friends. Stella may be pink, but she's definitely one of the Angry Birds, a fierce and feisty character with a great group of friends. Of course, no story is complete without some interesting frenemies."
Yes, and they go on to say, "Angry Birds Stella will open a door to a part of the Angry Birds universe you've never seen before. There will be plenty of fun and adventure, but the bunch of passionate pals will also have to deal with some serious issues in order to protect their friendship and the environment they live in. Luckily, Stella and her friends are good at finding creative solutions." End quote.
Did that sell it for you? It worked for me. I have to have this game now.
Unfortunately, the whole time, all I could help but think is, okay, so it's just going to be Angry Birds with another bird in different levels.
Yes. But maybe they're trying to, you know, gear it more towards a female demographic, a younger female demographic, because not only is it just going to be the game, because nothing Angry Birds is just the game anymore.
No, well,
let us bear that thought.
They clearly want to sell, you know, the plush Stella. They want to sell stickers involving Stella. They want more t-shirts with Stella on them, etc., etc. You can fill in the blanks.
No, certainly, but specifically, they've in the press release, they announced the tie-in marketing efforts to include things like games, animation, books, toys, and probably lunchboxes and even branded soft drinks. I don't know how that's going to work out. No details about those branded soft drinks were announced, just like no details about the game were mentioned, aside from the fact that it's a, you know, pink bird who probably is leading her group of frenemies against, well, evil pigs. Because... yes.
Well, yeah, because, or it's her friends against frenemies, right? Maybe she's friends with the evil pigs, but they just have to find creative ways to defeat them. I don't know. It's going to be an Angry Birds game. We don't really need to... Do we really need to know any more than that?
I say no. But then again, that's just me.
I'll be actually surprised if the game mechanics are startlingly different from any of the other millions of Angry Birds games that are out there right now. Honestly surprised.
Sounds like you're pretty cynical as well.
I might be, yes.
Now, perhaps I'm cynical as well, so I can't fault you for that. And perhaps you're like me and we share another similarity in that I feel this is just a poorly titled game. And when I hear the name Stella, I don't associate it with a pink bird, and nor am I going to associate it with a pink flying bird that's defeating frenemies or whatnot. I can't help but think, well, of a certain clip from The Simpsons.
Yes.
Perhaps you're thinking of the same thing I am?
Yes, I am. And, you know, we went to great lengths to try to grab an audio clip from it, but it proved to be a little bit difficult.
Technology not on our side this day, but
no.
All you have to do is simply look up the episode, A Streetcar Named Marge. And
yes, there's a very notable scene, line as yelled by Ned Flanders that kind of stuck with me for the greater part of the past 20 years.
Exactly, as he's singing, you know, "Stella, Stella, can't you hear me yella?
You're putting me through hella," etc., etc.
Stella!
Yeah, Stella! And I mean, every time I see the word Stella, it's always in Ned Flanders' voice. Always.
Makes it a little awkward when selecting a Stella Artois from a menu at a restaurant or some sort of...
Or going to a restaurant called Stella's or something.
There's that too. So yes, I'm sure many other people of our age range can't help but think of that as well. And I wonder if that came up in the conversations at all during the naming of this game.
It's entirely possible it didn't.
True point.
I mean,
Rovio being of Finnish and Scandinavian, origin.
It's possible Simpsons wasn't as much of a thing over there culturally as it was over here.
So I can understand if maybe it didn't have any significance or relevance, but, well, that's just a neat thing that we have to deal with now.
Yes,
but,
indeed.
But if pink burrs and frenemies aren't your thing, then just one last news item that we talk about here that will maybe just anger up your blood, maybe do some scaring of you, will be coming in the months ahead. It's the new game coming from Shinji Mikami, he being the creator and godfather of Resident Evil, otherwise known as Biohazard in Japan.
Yes, Biohazard.
But Resident Evil, the horror action franchise that has kind of diverged in recent years from its horror-centric origins.
It diverged from its survival horror origins to more of an action, arcade-y kind of experience in recent years with 4 through 6 and probably beyond.
Definitely, and I'm sure it's going to remain that way for years and years to come with the overly jacked-up Chris Redfield.
Yes, though that sort of kind of leaves the segment of the population that was more interested in the survival horror aspect of it sort of, you know, behind. I mean, I was more into the original Resident Evil games, despite their weird control schemes and whatnot.
Odd camera angles as well.
Yeah, but you get used to them, and you sort of get used to being truly kind of shocked by craziness that happens, as opposed to just the steady stream of enemies in an arcade-style game that aren't really shocking and just kind of a thing you have to deal with.
Indeed. So Shinji Mikami, he's gone back to his roots with this latest effort called The Evil Within, which in North America is getting released on August 26th and August 29th in Europe. So if you're kind of waiting for something to, you know, really carry you over, be a hardcore horror fix that will fulfill you in ways that Angry Birds Stella cannot, then perhaps The Evil Within is the game for you. And good news, it's coming out on basically everything that's not named Nintendo. Coming out to all new-gen and previous-gen systems, as well as PC. So, there's that.
Just with the exception of anything Nintendo.
Indeed. And also PlayStation Vita.
Yeah.
And WonderSwan.
Yes, and WonderSwan Color. But also Game Boy Color. Which also sort of brings us to one final thing we should probably mention before leaving you with this week. We forgot to mention it last week, but it's something that you should check out, aside from the Blast from the Past, which we will get to in a second, but it's something that has been kind of going on the internet for a while, and it's worth checking out just out of sheer morbid curiosity on Twitch TV right now. It's Twitch TV plays Pokemon. It's what happens when 20,000-ish people in the Twitch TV chat for this station all get together to control a game of Pokemon.
And are simultaneously submitting commands.
Yes. Even though, like, it's a little bit more complicated than that. They have a democracy system in place that you get to vote for democracy, and when democracy's in place, then it kind of takes up, you know, votes of the most X number of messages and kind of averages them out into what a command is. So it goes a little bit slower, but it's a little bit more reasonable that way, rather than letting the trolls completely take over. And, you know, when you get rid of making your characters accidentally get rid of Pokemon or whatnot, or deliberately losing battles and whatnot.
Not just trolls, but I also believe bots are also a part of the stream as well.
Yes.
Unavoidable.
Yes.
Part of it.
Bots created by people to try to screw things up.
Definitely.
Or make things ridiculous. Even more ridiculous. But yes, just do a little bit of a search for Twitch Plays Pokemon, or you can find the link to it on our website, thearcadeshow.com. We will definitely post a link there. But we are now into the end game of the program.
Indeed. The honest-to-goodness thing you should check out or try for this weekend, in addition to your honoring the memory of Harold Ramis with all his great comedy efforts, be they big screen or small screen.
Yes. this blast from the past, that is to say, we are into right now, this being another one of the classic comedy efforts that is now reaching a very big milestone. Within a couple days, actually, it will be 30 years old. And
30 years old, 30 years since the release of this movie on March 2nd, 1984, the movie being This is Spinal Tap.
Yes, it's a movie that I watch semi-regularly. It's a classic. It's the kind of movie that if you've never watched it, I'm pretty sure if you like comedy, you'll like This is Spinal Tap. It's pretty much like the movie that sort of launched the career of Christopher Guest as this type of filmmaker. Even though it wasn't made by him, his involvement with it sort of started him on this path that you kind of see from this movie moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it's a crazy cast in this movie. Like, in every possible way. It's a crazy cast where everyone underplays who they actually are and plays up this crazy character that they are playing. Everyone from Fran Drescher to Billy Crystal to, like, Fred Willard, and I can't say anything but good things about This is Spinal Tap. Every time I watch it, I probably catch something, some new subtle thing that was thrown in there, probably deliberately. It's got many, many layers.
If you're unfamiliar with This is Spinal Tap, and you maybe know the band, some of their efforts, maybe you just heard the song Break Like the Wind or something, but haven't actually seen the movie, I'm not familiar with it. It is a mockumentary.
Yes, a mock rockumentary.
Sorry, yes, a mock rockumentary about it's almost seminal, but perhaps bigger than they think they are, or think they're bigger than what they actually are, a band known as Spinal Tap, as they go on an adventure, go on a tour in support of their efforts making the album, as the documentarian, played by Rob Reiner, just chronicles their path in music.
Yes.
And the band, the three-piece outfit, with the rotating lineup of drummers.
Yes, well, three main members and several other members. Several other auxiliary members, with the joke being that their drummers keep dying.
Played by Harry Shearer,
Michael McKean, and
Christopher Guest.
Playing Nigel Tufnell, David St. Hubbins, and
Derek
Smalls.
There we go. He gets all three.
I get all three of them. You bet.
Bonus points for you, sir.
Yes. But classic movie. Absolutely classic. As a musician who's played some silly shows in the past, a lot of the musician humor is very on point. I mean, in part, mostly because all the comedians who play the parts are actually playing their instruments as well, which is that much more impressive, too.
Certainly. You've heard us on this program speak of the movie A Mighty Wind and the fact that Christopher Guest, Harry Shearer, Michael McKean, and pretty much everyone else in that movie is actually doing their parts, either vocals or you know, instrumentation.
Or whatever instruments that they're playing. Harpsichord, guitar, not harpsichord, but
auto
harp, guitar, banjo, ukulele, whatever else.
They're actually playing that, and because they're all talented musicians, and this was first demonstrated in movies in This is Spinal Tap, with Christopher Guest, Michael McKean, and Harry Shearer.
Although Michael McKean sort of had an additional kind of couple of musical spots on Laverne and Shirley years and years previous to that, but you know, you might not necessarily think of him as a musician, since he's also, like, a very famous comedian. But he's a really good guitar player. And, you know, Christopher Guest is also a really good guitar player. And Harry Shearer is a really good bass player. And they all wrote all the songs together. And they actually, like...
And they legitimately toured as Spinal Tap.
Yes, they've toured as Spinal Tap. They've toured as the Folksmen. They've toured as themselves, playing a mixture of material from Spinal Tap and the Folksmen. They're not just, you know, comedians who were just pantomiming things. They actually are into doing this thing, this music thing together.
They even released a follow-up album outside of the period of time when This is Spinal Tap, the movie, was culturally relevant. They released an album a few years after, I believe in 1989, 90.
I think it might have been 90, 91. Yeah, an album just called Break Like the Wind. with the title track that often gets stuck in my head, but it's just a standalone Spinal Tap album.
Just written, produced, and done by them, or written and played by them.
Yeah.
The three main actors, and as if that wasn't enough talent for you, another fun fact about the movie is that the majority of the dialogue was improvised.
Yeah.
They would have outlines for the scene, you know, where they needed to progress the story to, but, and certain points that maybe they absolutely had to get in, but the rest of it was improvised by them.
Yes. And Rob Reiner.
And Rob Reiner as well, yes.
Who was the director of the movie otherwise.
Certainly. And so if you've ever heard someone maybe just use the quote, "This goes to 11," yes, that's from Spinal Tap.
Yes, "This goes to 11," the whole tiny bread scene, which is probably my favorite scene in the movie, which you'll have to watch the movie to get if you've never seen it, but it's just, like, hilarious how, like, they'd show that they're these crazy prima donnas that are... and they just really bring the whole, you know, brown M&M story... They were doing the brown M&M story before Wayne's World did it. Way before Wayne's World did it.
Good point.
And it's just, you know, the craziness of rock stars and their ridiculous rider requirements and whatnot. Spinal Tap makes fun of that. There's a lot of other different subtle jokes as well with, you know, perhaps they don't explain it at all in the movie, but you visually see what looked to be herpes on on all of their faces. Just for one scene, and then that's it. Like it was just a flare-up or something.
I've always been a fan of the great sight gag of the Stonehenge.
Yes, of course. Stonehenge.
That has stuck with me through the years, and every time I see it, that is what I hang my hat on. That's what does it for me. I can't help it. And it's a fantastic movie all around. If you haven't watched it yet, then what the hell are you waiting for?
Yes.
You've had 30 years. Hopefully you have 30 more, but we can't wait 30 more years. We want you to watch it now. Not yesterday. Not in 3 weeks' time. Now.
Indeed.
At the conclusion of this podcast, you should have the film queued up, ready to go, and then play it, and then watch it, and enjoy it, to celebrate its 30th anniversary, which happens on March 2nd, as it came out on March 2nd, 1984. This is Spinal Tap.
Yes, and also, just a reminder, going back to the beginning of the program, also queue up a number of Harold Ramis classics.
Certainly.
We would suggest, at the very least, Ghostbusters, Caddyshack, Groundhog Day.
Stripes.
Animal House. And a bunch of old SCTV as well. Because, you know, that's just acceptable.
I think that's fair. And, you know, let us know how you are choosing to honor and celebrate the life and the work of Harold Ramis this weekend. How you can get in touch with us either on that or anything else that you want to get in touch with us with. Send us an email, info@thearcadeshow.com, or drop us a line through the Contact Us form on our website, thearcadeshow.com, or through the Twitters, @thearcadeshow, or on our Facebook thing. It's not a MySpace thing, it's a Facebook thing, because, well...
Well, MySpace is dead.
Well, sadly.
R.I.P.
One day it'll come back, like a phoenix, that it's clearly going to be one day, in my...
I doubt it.
In my thinking of MySpace, but until that time, we have the Facebook. It is facebook.com/thearcadeshow. So until next week, everybody, good night.
Good night.